ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National, where nothing's off limits.
You know, part of being an adult is dealing with discomfort.
We gather the sharpest minds around to hash over what's shaping this crazy world.
Both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party succumbed to big money.
Late Night Live, 4 new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on The Science Show, we're celebrating David Attenborough's 100th birthday.
And looking at the connection between vaccines, chook eggs and a dog from the 1950s.
We're heading to Cairns to look at ethical and social challenges to science and even to David Attenborough.
And what about the renowned Ian Chubb?
The thing about science, said the professor, is you can add up the benefits, the dollars and, with luck, the careers. But there's one ingredient you mustn't forget. And what's that, Professor?
In my public utterances, Rob and I remind people frequently, probably too frequently, that you've got to grab them by the heart first. When you've got their hearts and then they say, what is the evidence? You can give them the evidence, but the context is the heart.
I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith.
And yes, you need the heart to make it work. Ian Chubb quoting a minister, after the stats, the publications and the prizes, why does it matter? It's the heart. David Attenborough knows this, and I suspect so do you, Belinda Smith. Am I right? Emotion. Love.
No one does emotion quite like David Attenborough. I remember when I was a kid, we had Life on Earth on VHS tape. And in one episode, he goes to Rwanda to sit with the mountain gorillas. And the emotions he expressed there, the sheer happiness of being among romping, cheeky baby gorillas, and then also the sadness that their existence was being threatened by poachers, that's what made the moment so special and so memorable.
Yes, commitment, joy in nature. And we'll give a nod to David's magnificent birthday in today's Science Show, but the main tribute to him is in the complete special I produced, which is there online lasting a full hour. Do listen. Here, for instance, he is reflecting on his own museum that he put together when young.
I had a small museum as a boy. Many boys do. Mine contained a Victorian bun penny, the shed skin of a grass snake, some fossil ammonites, a twisted piece of metal from an incendiary bomb that had been dropped on Leicester where I lived, for this was during the war, and a small brown object 2¼ inches long. I can be quite precise about its measurements because I still have it. It's roughly rectangular with curved ribbed contours that have been beautifully polished. It's not cold, like stone, but warm to the touch. Lift it up, and I can see through it. And there within, at one corner, lies a small fly. It is, of course, a piece of amber, and I was given it by a girl, a refugee from Nazi oppression, who, in 1938, stayed in our house for a few weeks on her way to relatives in the United States. She'd come from a town not far from Gdansk, on the Baltic Sea. Gdansk is a city that's known all over Europe for its amber. There's a street there lined with shops, some big, some no more than wayside stalls, that sell nothing but amber. People living on this coast have collected and traded in amber since the Bronze Age 6,000 years ago. They found it on the beaches, cast up by the waves. Being lighter than sand and scarcely heavier than water, the pieces are deposited on the wet surface of the sand as if they're gifts from the sea.
David Attenborough describing his collection with heart. More from him later in this Science Show. But, Belle, what kinds of animal cells have you been pursuing in the cause of even better vaccines? Doggy ones?
In a sense. So we're getting into the cooler months, and that means it's time to get the annual flu vaccine. I got mine last weekend. I hope you've had yours, Robin.
I have.
Good to hear. Now, of the flu shots that are available this year, One is a bit different to the others, both in the way it was made and in the specific viruses it protects against. It's made by CSL Seqirus, so I popped in to chat to Head of Operations Chris Larkins about the vaccine. So one of the flu vaccines that Seqirus makes, Flucilvax?
Yes.
Is made an entirely different way to other flu vaccines that are currently available. How is it different?
Vaccines historically have been made out of eggs for decades. And it's a good way of making the flu vaccine because what we need to do at the very beginning of the process is to take a sample of the virus that matches the virus that's circulating in the community and make millions of them so that we can then purify it down to the proteins we want that will be the ultimate vaccine. And we've done that for decades in eggs. But as populations have grown and vaccination rates have improved and increased across the globe, just the amount of vaccines we need has gone up dramatically. And some of the issues with eggs is that you need to have a very sophisticated and large supply chain of chickens. And it got to a point in our facility here in Melbourne that we were getting almost 500,000 eggs every day needed to produce the vaccine. And with that comes a lot of supply chain robustness issues. We have to maintain huge flocks of birds. They have to be at laying ages continually around the year. And there's also biosecurity hazards that come into it, like the avian flu, which we've seen over the last few years. Just over the last decade or so, we have developed a new and a more modern way of producing the virus. And we've done that using mammalian cells and a mammalian cell line.
So you've been using this cell-based method for a few years now, and the first cell-based vaccines were rolled out in 2021 in Australia.
Yep.
So how does the cell-based system work, and where were the cells from?
The cells come from a mammalian cell line that has been, again, around for a long time. I think since the 50s it's been used and grown in laboratories and used for the production of biologic materials and vaccine materials. And we grow them up in large bioreactors, basically, up to 5,000 litre bioreactors at our facilities now. And what you do once you've got the cells grown and ready, you then infect them with the virus. And because they're a very close match to human cells, the virus multiplies dramatically, and that is the beginning of our process of producing the vaccine. There's probably one other benefit to the cell-based manufacturing process, and that is with the egg-based manufacturing process, the virus sometimes needs to adapt slightly to grow in the avian cells. And that can have a small impact on the effectiveness of the vaccine. And, you know, every so often we get a season where you might get this mismatch and it makes the vaccine not as effective as it should be. That issue is completely removed with the use of the mammalian cells because they're a better match to us as people.
The cells came from a dog way back in, what, the 1950s?
Yes.
Dog kidney cells.
Yes.
Why not use human cells?
When we grow these cells in the laboratory, we just want a very safe cell line that can be used over and over again. And this cell line, which was produced years ago, like you said, it's just a very convenient, easy way to grow the cells in the laboratory rather than using human cells.
I was going to say I could donate some cells if you needed some.
No, we've got
plenty. Okay, right. So you've got this new facility which has been open since the end of last year. How quickly can that produce vaccines? If there was a pandemic, mm-hmm. I don't know, tomorrow, God forbid,
yep.
How quickly could you turn around and start producing vaccines against a particular, just say it's a flu virus that becomes a pandemic?
We built this new facility out of Tullamarine. It's replacing the facility we had here in Melbourne that used the egg-based technology. It's capable of producing 150 million doses of pandemic vaccine within the first wave of the pandemic, which is around about sort of 4 to 6 months' time. So we target to have at least two doses for every Australian in those initial months of a pandemic.
How does that compare to if you had the egg-based way of making vaccines? How much quicker is that?
We had the same sort of timeframes for the egg-based vaccines. With the new technology, I think it just adds an enormous amount of robustness, better matches, supply chain security, control, and we can store all of the raw materials can be sitting there as a stockpile for us ready to go rather than needing a risky supply chain with chickens.
Mm-hmm. So that's Flucilvax. CSL Seqirus also makes Fluad.
Yes.
Which is for older people. Is that still made in eggs?
It is. I actually got my Fluad shot yesterday, which is giving away my age a bit. Yeah, so we still make that in eggs. So eggs are still a very good method for making the flu vaccine in terms of its effectiveness. We are looking eventually to shift to a cell-based vaccine for the elderly, but that's still a couple of years away.
I noticed that two of the three flu strains in the egg-based and cell-based vaccines are the same, but one of the influenza A strains is different. So it's a Singapore strain in the egg-based shots,
yes,
and Sydney strain in the cell-based shots. Why is that?
Yeah, it's to do with the growth characteristics of the individual strains. Some strains grow better in eggs and in cell, and so the WHO, the World Health Organization, does all of the surveillance globally and chooses the strains for the individual seasons, but it does a lot of testing on them, obviously, before handing them over to manufacturers, and then we do our own testing on these strains. So it is possible that sometimes we do choose a different strain, but they are very alike in terms of where they sit in terms of the mutations that they have and where they sit in the evolution of the flu virus. They're usually very close.
Chris Larkins, Head of Operations at CSL Seqirus.
Thanks, Bill. This is The Science Show on Radio National, where at the start I mentioned Professor Ian Chubb, former Chief Scientist and a Vice-Chancellor. And it was interesting, at Anna Maria Arabia's farewell last week at the Academy of Science, she mentioned one of her life's lessons was that Ian Chubb is always right. Well, he seems to have been right about helping lead the review of our science. Ambitious Australia, it's called.
It was a great experience, Robin. That panel was one of the best panels that I've ever worked with. We were four people from divergent backgrounds. We didn't know each other beforehand, and we worked so well together that I think we produced an excellent report.
Fiona Wood, in fact, from Perth, a former Australian of the Year, famous for spray-on skin and fostering so much in the way of research. It's quite incredible. Now, when I was last in this building, we're sitting in the Academy of Science building in Canberra, you were celebrating the fact that via science and health research, you have managed to come through some fairly severe medical problems.
Well, yes, I was diagnosed by chance. Because of my age, they were doing an ultrasound to see how well my prostate was going. And they saw a lump on the kidney. And about 3 or 4 weeks later, I lost that kidney. The assumption at the time was that the pathology was on my side. But when the follow-up CT scan showed that it had metastasized to my lungs, the whole ball game changed. I had a prognosis of 3 to 5 months. If I didn't do anything. The opportunity at that time was chemo. I had a very good oncologist looking after me, and I never forget his eyes when he was reading the pathology report in front of me. And he rang a colleague in Sydney and said he got a clinical trial on. And they had one. Some months later, I got admitted to the trial. That was about 12 years ago.
What was the basis of the idea behind the trial?
It was immunotherapy. And there were two antibodies. So at that time, they were beginning this idea that you have more than one agent at a time. And so I got two antibodies. One was to stop vascularization of the tumours, which were growing quite rapidly. And the other was a PD-L1 blocker. So basically, it gave my own immune system opportunity to recognise this as foreign and knock it off. And it did. It did it remarkably quickly because I was getting big accumulation of fluid in my thorax towards the end. I couldn't breathe and all that, you know, couldn't walk 20 metres, and it was pretty ordinary. So they did an x-ray after about three treatments to see whether I still had fluid in the lung. I had 4 litres drained out. I mean, I'm not a little bloke, right? So 4 litres is a lot of stuff to be flopping around inside your thorax, stopping your lungs expanding. And not only did they see no fluid, they didn't see the lesions in my lung.
Well, this is so important because we're actually here to talk about your Ambitious Australia report and so on, and the action on it. But here is yet another example of the way science works. As you implied, a few years ago, that kind of approach wasn't there, but science has tried things and got results, and many people these days around Australia and around the world know about the way you can harness your immune system and live longer. But now, back to the report, Are you pleased with the reception it's had, even though it's quite new?
Well, I've described it, Robin, as frighteningly positive. And I use the word frighteningly because I don't want people to think that all they have to do is be positive about it and it will happen. It's the end of stage one and the beginning of stage two. And I don't know how many stages there are to come. But now it's about the implementation of it, and the support for the implementation has been remarkably widespread and remarkably strong. And I'm very pleased with that because I'm actually very proud of the report and proud of the work that we did as a panel, much better than any one of us could have done on our own. But it's setting out what an ambitious Australia has to do. And we carefully tied it to a purpose, and that purpose is intergenerational equity and justice. The Federal Treasurer has been talking a lot about that in the last year at least, and we make the point in there that the intergenerational reports over 20-odd years have changed the GDP per capita estimations, have dropped by about 30 or 40%. So we're not handing on a good legacy, and we all felt we have an obligation to try to set the country up so those who come after us get a good quality of life. And in order to do that, you've got to do something. You can't just presume it will happen because somebody will find another rusty hill to dig up and flog off and wait for the market prices to determine your quality of living.
Yeah, but the politics of the day, necessarily these days even more so, is next week's shopping and the bills you have to pay immediately, not what happens with one generation, maybe two generations down the track.
Yeah, I agree. And I hate to be a politician. I wouldn't want their job for quids. But they've got to make choices. And they spend, I don't know what the federal budget will be this year in cash outlays, but probably $1.5 trillion, something like that. Within that, you've got to draw priorities and you generate enough enthusiasm and enough commitment to deliver on them. And I'm much heartened by the fact that the Federal Treasurer has also talked about intergenerational equity. We had a quote that started on the front cover of the report but didn't end up there, where we talk about how he said, the quote from Jim Chalmers was, "This is the defining decade. This is when we make choices that will determine the quality of life of Australians into the future." And so, sure, you've got to worry about petrol prices today. You've got to worry about the price of groceries. I don't deny that that's important. But you can't be only short term. You've got to marry the short term with the longer term, the vision, the way in which we, as this country of ours, can invest in a way that gives the future generations, our kids and grandkids, they're not unrelated to us, right? What are we going to do?
Well, you've been reading another Minister of Science's reflections, Kim Carr, and a particular paragraph struck you. What did that paragraph say?
Yes, so I've known him for a long time, and Kim was on the ANU Council when I was Vice-Chancellor, for example. And so I was reading his book. He's got a paragraph in there where he's talking about his time as science minister, and he was a very good science minister. We've had a few good people in science. John Howard was a good prime minister for science, backing Australia's Ability 1 and 2. I mean, these were significant contributions to the country. And anyway, Kim talks about how when scientists go to see him as the science minister, they give him a truckload of evidence. And he says they assume it then turns into suitable policy they want, obviously. And he said, but what they forget is that when they tell a politician, it becomes emotional. And so in my public utterances since then, Robin, I remind people frequently, probably too frequently, that you've got to grab them by the hearts first. When you've got their hearts, and then they say, what is the evidence? You can give them the evidence, but the context is the heart. Why would they want to do this? What is the betterment? What is the improvement? What is the investment going to lead to? How will people be better off as a consequence of that investment? And if you get them thinking in those terms, and the evidence to back that up is there and available to you, you're actually beginning to tell a story and sell a story. If you just think the evidence is all they need, it will be interpreted by some as just more money into a research community, which most people think is broken anyway. And that's what the report basically says. You've got to fix the system and then put more money into the system that's fixed, not more money into a system that's broken. So fix it, get that right, invest in it, and you invest in it so that you can hand on quality of life to coming Australians, people who live in this country. And in order to do that, you've got to get their hearts first.
I'm going to tell you a brief story, and then we'll leave it for the time being, but I want to come back to you. You mentioned John Howard, you mentioned the heart. It just so happened when I came down from Oxford, I had a couple of fellowships and I landed at the end of the 90s when the ABC had had a 12% cut. And I happened to write to the then minister, Peter McGoran, on the coalition side. Now, it just so happened that when Peter McGoran was appointed as the shadow, the minister, Barry Jones, took him aside and said, the key to this is to go around the country to see where science is done, to visit the laboratories where people are doing it, and listen to them, see how it actually works, and see how science connects to the community. In other words, you don't just see science as a distant thing remotely. And Peter McGoran did that. And when I went to see him, because of the problem with covering science with that enormous cut, he listened. He said, what would you do if you had the funds? And I gave him the list, like National Science Week, internships, those sorts of things. And that was costed. And he gave us $2 million. Yeah, yeah. And I said, how'd you get that through Cabinet? He said, John Howard listens to the program. You know, you're dead right about the heart. Yeah, yeah. And the involvement.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's a good story, Robin. And I think I sat one seat down from John Howard at Prime Minister's Science Council in those days. And I remember a presentation came in to talk about a synchrotron. And I'd been told beforehand, watch what he writes down. And one of his advisors was sitting behind him. And if he hands a note back, there's a fair chance, it's a positive response. Without guarantees, but a fair chance. And they came in, gave a presentation on the synchrotron. We got a synchrotron.
Congratulations.
Oh, I didn't do it. I was just there as a wide-eyed 42-year-old or something, thinking, God, this is how the place works. But I learned a lot. So we're supporting the minister who has expressed his support for the report. We're helping him as best we can to make sure that we get the whole thing implemented. The recommendations are interdependent. I'm personally very alert to cherry picking. I've watched that happen for 50 years and that's long enough. I don't want to see it again. And we've got to do it carefully, but we've got to do it all.
It's all one connected plan for our future. Professor Ian Chaba, the Academy of Science in Canberra. The Science Show on Radio National. And Bell, before we hear from you about an exoplanet, here's birthday boy David Attenborough once more. A reminder that he too did it all, not just in the field filming aardvarks, but in the BBC pioneering new ways of broadcasting about ideas, all of them.
We may not realise just how much David Attenborough created the television we know today. The World About Us was the first hour-long documentary strand. Its success led to greater things.
We just did let ourselves go a little and set up a programme called Civilization, which was to show in colour all the loveliest pictures and loveliest buildings in the whole of Europe.
It does seem hard to believe that European civilization can ever vanish. And yet, you know, it has happened once.
Civilization, presented by Kenneth Clark, was the first of the Landmark series. Jewels in the crown of BBC television.
I was most proud of the dynasty of things that started with civilization and went on to the ascent of man. Those two, it seemed to me, inaugurated a new kind of television documentary, which have had a number of descendants, but in their time they were innovative, and I think they actually enriched people's lives. And what more do you want?
Achievement in pioneering the philosophy of colour television programmes in Britain, the winner is David Attenborough.
David was rewarded for his work by being promoted to BBC Director of Programmes. but he missed his film trips to wild places and asked that occasionally he be allowed out of his suit.
I think he was very proud of colour and two and so on. I mean, I think he derived great satisfaction from that and pride, rightly. But it wasn't his scene. Sitting in an office was not his scene. His scene is out somewhere in those ridiculous trousers that are likely to fall off at any moment, or up to his eyes and knees and God knows what. That's Dave's world.
You know, there's a whole generation watching now who never saw that magic moment in Borneo when you were underground in the cave full of bats.
Yeah.
And you were standing in the pile of, the 20-foot high pile, what will I call it?
Droppings?
Droppings. Anyway.
Nor is it just simply bat droppings or bird droppings. It's much more complicated than that, because the entire surface of it is covered with a glistening, moving carpet of cockroaches.
And I've always wanted to ask this question. How did you feel?
Well, I tell you, I stood at the top of that pile, choking with ammonia.
This cave, this particular part of it, ammonia is really quite choking.
And the director, who was at the bottom, of course, was shouting up, and he said, say something, talk to the camera about what it's like, you see. So I looked at the camera and said,
this immense number of bats flying round here in a panic, not one of them is colliding with the other, nor indeed am I in any danger whatsoever of being hit by them.
And they don't fly into your hair or anything because they are so clever with this ultrasound.
And the old fear that people have of bats getting caught in their hair is actually quite unfounded.
And the director said, terrific, cut, and a bat went boom.
And the bat hits him whack on the head. The film's called Life on Air. Gorgeous stuff. David Attenborough spent lots of time filming anthropological stories, and you'll see his vast collection of material from around the world on the show. He also records in his book Life on Air how open-minded you need to be about people and cultures which are unfamiliar. Part of the BBC tribute to David from my Science Show special, and you can hear it in full online. Just go to our website. He's now 100. And when I phoned his London home number last week for advance good wishes, his daughter Susan said, well, I'm sorry, he's at work. Of course, where else at 100? Belle, take us into space before we hear about what David Attenborough may, just for a while, have been keeping quiet about.
Yes, let's leave planet Earth for just a minute for our second instalment of Weather Off Earth, where we check out the conditions on other planets. Last time, we looked at rain. Today, it's wind. Now, Robin, a quick question for you. What's the strongest non-tornado wind recorded on Earth?
Oh, let's say 700 kilometres per hour.
You've gone too high. That's fine, though.
It's rough where I come from.
The strongest recorded wind speed, not in a tornado, was just over 400 kilometres an hour, almost exactly 30 years ago, actually, in April of 1996, and it was recorded on Barrow Island, which is off the Western Australian coast. But this 400 kilometres, or even your guess of 700, they both pale in comparison to the winds that whip around planets elsewhere. To explain how we know this, here's University of Southern Queensland astronomer Dr. Chelsea Huang, starting with what wind is.
I like to think about wind as the rapid movement of air, and this movement is usually powered by what we call pressure gradients. So if you have a region of air that's got heated rapidly, the air will rise and it will leave a low pressure point. In contrast, cold regions, the air will condense and cause a high pressure point, and this pressure difference will drive wind. So usually around the coast, we have quite a bit winds just because the ocean and the land got heated at different rate and also cooled down at different rate. During spring and autumn, we usually have fairly strong wind just because the temperature difference between the equator and the poles are quite large during those seasons. On other planets, wind is actually quite a common phenomena.
Okay, so how are they different from what we experience here on Earth?
different planets has very different wind. This usually depends on how their atmosphere is heated. You can imagine extreme wind usually happen in the type of planets that's really unevenly heated and with puffy atmosphere. Actually, extreme wind also happens in the type of planet we call ultra-hot Jupiters. And because these planets get heated on one side, they can have huge temperature contrast between day and night. The temperature contrast between the day and night can be thousands of degrees. And this will drive really huge equatorial wind. Just for reference, on Earth, when we have a wind that's about 100 kilometers per hour, we have a tornado or a cyclone. On these planets, the wind speed can reach up to 1 to 10 kilometers per second.
Whoa.
And this is about 10 to 100 times faster than the strongest wind on Earth.
Wow. Okay, so my sheets would dry very, very quickly in these winds, I'm hearing. Wow. Okay. So, okay, and this is the result of these really massive differences in temperature in the atmosphere.
Yes.
And they're causing these really strong high pressure and low pressure systems, and that pushes the atmosphere from the high pressure to the low pressure systems, causing these really strong winds.
Yes, and we think these winds as a huge atmospheric jets go along the equator of these planets.
And so do they normally travel around the equator? Do we see those sort of equatorial belts more often than other things?
We believe they are more likely to be the equatorial belts because we also see winds similar to this on Jupiter. You can see the belts of Jupiter, which are usually caused by phenomena like wind.
So I'm guessing that we don't have weather stations on these exoplanets. So how do you know the wind speed on these ultra-hot Jupiters, which are, you know, tens, hundreds, maybe thousands of light years away from Earth?
We can actually observe the speed of wind using this phenomena called the Doppler effect. You might be familiar with the Doppler effects for sound. You most likely experience it around the moving train. When the train moves towards you, you hear a high-pitched sound. And when the train moves away from you, you hear a low-pitched sound.
And if you don't live near train tracks, like me, it's also the sound of an ambulance's siren, which sounds higher as the ambulance is driving towards you, but lower after it passes you and is driving away.
Yes. The same effects happen to light, too. So when the light is traveling towards you, it causes a blue shift. And the light is traveling away from you, it causes a red shift. And so this is just when we have measured the wavelengths of the light, we can tell if the light is bluer or redder.
So you have a telescope pointed at an exoplanet, and you're picking up the light from its star as it filters through the gas of the planet's atmosphere.
And if the light is traveling through a gas that's moving at very high speed, we observe similarly the blue shift and red shift phenomena. And when you have equator jets along the planet, you have really large red shift on one side of the planet and really large blue shift on the other side of the planet. And that's actually how we can measure the speed of these wind on a planet that's hundreds of light years away.
Dr. Chelsea Huang, an astronomer at the University of Southern Queensland.
This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National with some thoughts about David Attenborough, just turned 100, and for some time, as concerns built about climate and conservation, a few, such as journalist George Monbiot, complained that David was avoiding the bigger issues while showing us comfy confections about glorious nature. In fact, of course, David Attenborough was calling himself not a scientist, but a journalist, and thinking deeply about the conflicts of how ethically to report evidence. So here, for example, is what a professor of sociology at James Cook University in Cairns thinks about the quandary. Meet Stuart Lockie.
I come from a generation, may I tell you, Professor, that you mention the word sociologist and the scientists run like fire.
Well, indeed, when I first became a sociologist with a background in agriculture, yeah, sociology was all about criticising science, pulling it apart, showing how observations are theory-laden and institutionally driven. But then along came climate change and we all went, shit. Maybe we need a more constructive relationship.
And how do you get a more constructive relationship?
Well, I think there's a few things you need to do, and one is start actually working with other scientists. I don't care whether you're in the social, natural, humanities, whatever, engineering, medicine, you've got to start getting outside of your bubble, understand the world from other people's point of view, and just get in there and debate it. Work on common problems, identify a mission that you can work on together.
Are there examples of that going on here in Northern Queensland where that success has been achieved?
Sure, there's lots of examples. The most important program I've been involved with in recent years has been the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program, which has articulated a global mission to really change the way we approach managing ecosystems and providing the sorts of the scientific tools, the modelling tools, the social engagement tools to enable people to do that in order to not give up on climate mitigation, but to find ways of dealing with the climate change that's forced on us anyway.
Give me a concrete example of how that has happened.
Well, we realised pretty soon that you can ask the general population what they think about all sorts of new technologies, and for the most part, they'll say, that sounds like a good idea, researchers should look into that. Does that mean that we can actually use them at some point in a specific place at a specific time? Well, that's when other things come into play. Maybe there's other rights. There's fishing rights, there's traditional use rights. And it starts at that point. This becomes some sort of a collective decision, not something that's just devolved to another authority. So we set up a regional network of people involved in reef conservation and reef restoration so we could start working together from the very local scale that a lot of community groups were already active through to the regional scale that the research program wanted to activate.
So no-fish zones seemed a very good idea because you are putting them where you have a need to restock variety of species and so on. And there is always a leakage across the zone that there's no fence there, but the fish don't know where they're not supposed to go. And so it's an improvement for the fishers on the outside the no zone. And so isn't that so obvious a success?
Well, indeed. And I think the sort of social conflict that we had when the reef was rezoned and the existing green zones were established, it was probably a thing of the past. And I think people have come to accept zoning as being important because of those ecosystem services it delivers. But let me say, 30 years ago, the great love of my life was gainfully employed in establishing marine protected areas in the Philippines, which have been tremendous for livelihoods, as you say, for providing the fish that feed people and give them an income. But the great love of my life is an anthropologist. You know, for her, it was all about the people, because it's not just about money and it's not just about biomass. It's about culture and identity and people's belonging in a landscape. And when we think about the way reef traditional owners in Australia interact with the reef, it's not as a marine wilderness that's out there. It's as a part of their community. And so the sort of cultural and linguistic attachments with the reef, they're not from a different universe to those of non-Indigenous Australians, but another important way of understanding that ecosystem that actually becomes even more important when we think about climate change and the need to be active in how we manage landscapes rather than just putting fences around them.
Let me give you a personal example. I broadcast on the Science Show several times, and that's somebody called Jeremy Leggett, who actually started off as someone lecturing in geology of how to extract fossil fuels. And when he got to know the industry, he was so disgusted, he became the chief scientist of Greenpeace. Now he's transformed himself, having educated some people such as Naomi Oreskes, who's quite well known in Harvard. She wrote the book called Merchants of Doubt, suggesting that the people involved in fossil fuel industry were simply copying the cigarette trade and saying, yeah, there's no problem there, you know, it's your choice, it's a legal thing, just carry on. Anyway, Jeremy Leggett is now rewilding, with help from Oxford University and lots of friends, the main big areas around Scotland. And he's consulting the local people. He's saying, we're not going to ban farming, but we want you as part of the dialogue of how we're going to do it far better, because otherwise it's not going to last. Mm. So that kind of example is going well, and that's why he won the Blue Planet Prize last year worth $1 million.
I think here on the Queensland coast, you'll see much more coastal restoration being factored into the story around protecting the reef. I mean, you're absolutely right. The merchants of doubt writ large do a trade in false polemics and in convincing people that they're in a minority when they care and want to do something productive, or where they see some nuance and need to compromise, the need to hold more than one thing's true at the same time. whether we look at what Australians in general think about action on climate change, you would never read those surveys and think, my goodness, we'll have a climate war. Yeah, we'll feed this into these silly left-right polemics. But of course, the merchants of doubt have convinced people that they're in the minority when they want to see action and when they want to care. And so I think one of the important jobs we have to do is to reinforce in people's mind that actually most of their fellow Australians want to build community, want to take action on climate, want to care for local ecosystems. But circling back to this landscape repair, I think, you know, there's plenty of evidence that the things that are really making a difference for the reef, because you've seen reporting, hard coral cover declined last season, but it's generally been on an upward trajectory. That's because of protected areas within the reef, crown of thorns control, it's better environmental management, helping counter some of those climate impacts. And I think coastal restoration is going to become a bigger part of that picture because it plays such an important role in arresting the flow of nutrients out into the reef, but it's also what people see and it engages people and makes it real, because otherwise the reef is just this romantic vision on the horizon or apocalyptic vision on the horizon, depending on how they're emotionally feeling on that day, whereas a Melaleuca wetland is real all the time, every time you run or walk through it.
There it is, yeah. What do you think about some of the actions of the people who used to be called the Climate Commission and then the Climate Council, involving people like Tim Flannery and Leslie from Macquarie University, going to places where people want to engage in a town hall chat, where you actually listen to the doubters, find something in common and continue the conversation that way?
I think it's tremendously important. And I have to be honest, most of what I do is talk to the true believers. And maybe that's me being in my comfort space. I like being a member.
You're a sociologist, that's why.
Oh, yeah. I'm also a volunteer tree plant. I like going and working up a sweat on the weekends, digging holes and putting seedlings into them. And I like gazing into the forest and thinking, wow, so much of the forest around Cairns was planted 30 years ago. And now it looks like this amazing place. And it says we can actually make a positive difference. The world is not necessarily all going bad.
Stuart Lockie, Professor of Sociology at James Cook University in Cairns. And as you know, David Attenborough did finally lift his restraint about climate change when, as he told me in the Science Show, the chemical evidence became overwhelming. Evidence. Here we are in the ABC studio for my last interview with him about his love of Australia. David Attenborough, welcome to the ABC studio. I would like to show you an object which you, with any luck, can identify with reasons. And I'm putting on the table my microphone, which I used as recently as last Friday. Do you remember having one of those?
Oh, absolutely.
I saw a picture of it in your memoirs.
Yeah, they weigh a ton, don't they?
Yeah.
And I think I was smoking a cigarette in that picture.
You were?
I was trying to record frogs in Sierra Leone in the swamp. And I've got this in one hand, this huge thing the size of a suitcase hanging over, which was the first mobile tape recorder. And this, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I still use it. And I use it because it's so reliable. Yeah.
Crikey, you're a strong man.
That is a microphone.
Yeah, it is, and a half. And it's pretty bashed, too.
Yeah. But when you drop it, it improves. The point of showing you this is, yes, of course, the extent to which technology has changed incredibly, very much in your field. I know you've talked about that in Australia before, ways in which you can invade the privacy of these tiny animals as they're doing intimate things. Does it still astonish you how much can be done with the new technology?
Yes, what astonishes me is how little can't be done, if you see what I mean. You really do anything now. You're hard pushed to it to try and think what would be unfilmable. The huge change, in fact, amazingly didn't recognise it at the time, or how all-pervasive it is. The huge change was to electronics from film. Not only, of course, is the electronic camera so much more sensitive than any emulsion that camera people have been able to produce, but it's also the fact that you can run it for 24 hours, which you could never do with film, so that it means you can stake out somewhere for 24 hours or more and see if something happens in that 24. You don't have to be a cameraman there. And then you whiz through at high speed and see whether anything went across. And then it's so small, it has simply everything for going for it. And that has had a huge change on what we've been able to film.
Yeah, I remember when they were filming the gastric brooding frog and they had to be there with their
10-minute
film.
That's right.
And staying up all night just in case it actually looked after the offspring and put various offspring in the mouth. And it was so fleeting that you had the team in Adelaide up all night. Of course, the opposite of that is that in Oxford, where Betty the Crow was doing amazing things with tools, and they discovered that only because someone had left the video running. The thing was going all night, and suddenly there was this amazing picture of a creature behaving in a completely different way from what they expected. Let me take you on a bit of a tour around Australia, starting actually with Lord Howe Island, where I was earlier on this year, and where the naturalist Ian Hutton looked up from the shore where we were looking at tiny crabs. And he said, you see the mountain, you're not going up there because you're a bit of a wimp. But David Attenborough, when he was here, went up there, and it is bloody high, if you know Lord Howe Island.
It is.
How did you manage that?
God knows. I tell you what, though, I couldn't walk the following day. I mean, it really took him out of it. And the reason we went up wasn't just bravado or silliness. The amazing thing is that when you get up to the top, you can make any kind of noise. Doesn't matter what noise it is. I mean, bashing two tin lids together or shrieking. And then seabirds of various species will flop through to see what's going on. Absolutely extraordinary.
Yes, you can call them down from the forest before you go up them.
That's right.
They're curious and wonderfully tame.
Yeah, wonderful.
Is that why you went up there to see the birds?
Yes.
Were you filming at the time?
Yeah, certainly.
It's a fabulous place, isn't it?
It is. And then, of course, you've got that great stick insect, which they're breeding in Melbourne, aren't they?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah,
huge thing. Take us around Australia to some of the places that really have impressed you. Let's start, well, actually in the West, because you've just been to Perth and you had a spider named after you. Was it a cute spider?
I couldn't see it. It sounded 2 millimetres long.
That wasn't a bit of a
pop-down. Well, I mean, I could just... under a lens, I'm sure, it's got a most attractive face. Have you got things named after you?
Only a star.
What do you mean, only a star? A whole galaxy, perhaps?
No, a star, but slightly bigger than a spider. But a couple of years ago, I remember someone else who used to be in Western Australia, Dr. John Long, published this wonderful paper with his colleagues about the invention of pleasurable sex by a fish.
Exactly.
365 million years ago in Western Australia.
Yes.
And that fish was named after you as well, wasn't it?
It was, but why, if it's the inventor of pleasurable sex, is it named after me?
Only you can answer that. Well, just to make it clear, it was internal fertilisation, and John Long and his colleagues had actually found that the young were carried live, and so there was internal fertilisation, and there was a way in which it could actually live there for a little while.
Yes, it is not just internal fertilisation, because you can have an egg, as it were, in the pouch, and then fertilise that egg. The fact is that the female was able to sustain the growing embryo, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what makes it a sort of a competitor with the mammals, I would say.
Have you been to Gogo, where the fish fossils
certainly,
were found?
Certainly I have. And that, I think, is why John was so flattering as to name it after me. Gogo is an extraordinary place. As a matter of fact, when we wanted to film there, I have to say this, and you probably know it anyway, but it was a British scientist who discovered those first fossils in Gogo, and he took them all away in order to work out how to prepare them, which they did in London. And that didn't go down all that well in those days.
Touch of the Elgin marbles.
Well, exactly. And so when I came back, I said to the geologist who's in charge of the place, I'd like to go and film. And he said, why? Why are you going to? There's nothing there. He said, you blokes come across from England, you know, and you think you took it. Of course, you did a rotten job. You left all sorts of good stuff. But then we went and did a proper job and actually cleaned it up. So there's absolutely nothing there now. So why do you want to go and see it? I said, well, I want to go and see it, to look at the landscape and explain about fossil reefs and one thing or another. So, rather reluctantly, I have to say, he and I and the film team, got a helicopter, and we went off. And when we landed, I went out first, and I stood on a lump of rock about a foot across, and on it there was a most extraordinary rectangular plate with lovely pattern on the surface. I hadn't the faintest idea what it was. And he, the geologist, came after me, and I said, what on earth is that? And he said, you bastard.
It wasn't.
It was. It was one of the bits of one of these fish that he said he had cleared up. However, he was a good bloke. He'd let me keep it. So there it is. And it's one of the head scutes of one of those enormous armoured fish that were the swanning around in the Devonian period.
Yeah, it's an amazing trove. Going towards the coast, the Great Barrier Reef, of course, is also in jeopardy. And, of course, there the problem is not just one element, maybe climate changing, yeah, but several, overfishing, the pollution from the land, and even a structure 2,500 kilometres long cannot withstand three attacks at once.
Oh, I lower my voice because the doom, the thought that the world might lose the Great Barrier Reef, and because you're going to lose a universe, really, of every form of water life that you can think of. And everybody knows how wonderful the Barrier Reef is. Perhaps not everybody knows what a key it is to the whole life of the oceans. And if you lose those reefs, you lose the nurseries where the young of so many fish grow up. And the disaster would be just unspeakable. And I'm not sure what can be done about it. It's the rising sea levels that are causing these initial problems.
Of course, people have got the vague idea that the reefs have been dealing with sea level rise for a long time and they could just move, go south or, you know, grow further up or go further down.
The sea level's only one problem. I mean, the even bigger problem is the acidification of the water, really. I mean, the increasing levels of carbon in the atmosphere, which is absorbed by the sea, is in the form of CO2, which turns into carbonic acid, which changes the acidity of the oceans, which are key to the survival of corals. And if that acidification goes on, it's difficult to know how the corals, as we know them, can survive. The point, of course, is that these changes of this magnitude are just a moment in the geological record, but a moment we're only, human beings are only here for a geological record. And as for the generation, my generation, your generation, and our grandchildren and so on, that's hardly registers at all. And within that time scale, this disaster could happen. Yeah. And if the reefs were to recover, that's not going to be for centuries.
What would you like to see happen to make them
well,
safe?
Well, the key element is the amount of carbon in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And that is not affecting not only the reefs, but everything.
When the evidence is clear, Attenborough, the journalist, speaks out. And now he's 100.
And that interview was recorded in 2012, so 14 years ago. And Sir David rightly mentions these threats to the Great Barrier Reef, ocean acidification and rising sea levels. But there wasn't as much talk at the time of heat stress to marine ecosystems. And since that interview was recorded, the Great Barrier Reef has been absolutely hammered by heat. It suffered mass coral bleaching in 2016, 2017, 2020, 2022, 2024 and 2025. And of course, marine heat waves don't just affect the Great Barrier Reef. They affect corals all around Australia and the world, and seagrass meadows and other kinds of marine ecosystems. So this really shows how quickly things are changing in the environment. The pressure's building and the urgency of the situation is only ramping up.
As mentioned, we have a full life tribute to this marvellous broadcaster, and that's there for you on the Science Show website. Next week, Rose Kerr with Kingsley Dixon, and also Brian Schmidt on how the universe may not be expanding quite as fast as we thought. Dark energy, like oil supplies, may be slowing down. So cheerio from me, Robin Williams.
And me, Belinda Smith. We'll catch you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.